Good evening. I'd like to call the April 17th, 2018 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature to order. I want to say that a lot of us are wearing winter clothes, so let the record show we're doing so under protest. With that, would you join me in the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
Pledge of Allegiance to the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands. One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call of members. Ms. Callis. Mr. Klein.
Here.
Ms. Corman.
Here.
Mr. Lane.
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne.
Present.
Mr. McKenna.
Here.
Mr. Morey has asked to be excused. Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Ms. Black?
Here.
Ms. Champion?
Here.
Ms. Dawson?
Here.
Mr. Granison?
Yes.
Mr. John? Ms. Robertson?
Here.
We have 11 members present. Thank you. We have a number of petitions or proclamations tonight, and I'd like to start with Ellen Morris-Noer from the Ithaca Board of Realtors, who asked us to recognize fair housing, the fair housing law. So I'll read this and come on up, and we'd love to have you say a few words. Yes. Whereas April 11, 2018 marked the 50th anniversary of the passage of the U.S. Fair Housing Law, Title 8 of the Civil Rights Act of 1968, as amended, which enunciates a national policy of fair housing without regard to race, color, religion, sex, handicap, familial status, and national origin. The state of New York adds creed, disability, marital status, age, blindness, hearing impairment, use of a hearing service or guide dog, sexual orientation, military status, and domestic violence victim. And whereas the Tompkins County Legislature, as well as the Ithaca Board of Realtors, are committed to highlighting the fair housing law, Title 8 of the Civil Rights Act of 1968, by continuing to address discrimination in our community, to support programs that will educate the public about the right to equal housing opportunities, and to plan partnership efforts with other organizations to help assure every American of their right to fair housing. Now, therefore, I, Martha Robertson, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim April 2018 as Fair Housing Month, and let it begin a year-long commemoration of the U.S. Fair Housing Law in Tompkins County, and urge all citizens to wholeheartedly recognize this celebration throughout the year.
The Ithaca Board of Realtors is very grateful to have the community behind us. We know that our licenses are on the line, and therefore we're on the front lines of enforcing fair housing practices every time we open our mouth and talk to people. So we really appreciate knowing that the larger community and the county is behind us. We'll be having several events throughout the year, especially we train our realtors, our agents, to make sure they understand the complexities of dealing with the diversity of our market, of our community, and the respect that really gains for the whole community. We really believe in the sense that diversity is the secret to the health of our community. Having lots of different people represented and people aware of each other's needs and rights really lays the foundation of a healthy economy. So we in the housing market are really appreciative that the whole county is recognizing that. Thank you very much, Martha, and all of the members of the legislature.
Thank you, Ellen, and thank you. And thank Norma Jane, who asked us to have this recognition. We really do appreciate it. Is Lindsay Lehman here? Wonderful. Come on up, Lindsay, from Tompkins Courtland Community College. I have a proclamation requested by Lindsay and her group. Whereas Tompkins Courtland Community College, TC3, as a community, recognizes that the responsibility to bring an end to domestic and sexual violence lies with all of us. And whereas TC3 recognizes all forms of sexual assault as acts of violence and continues to advocate for an end to violence against both men and women. And whereas TC3 acknowledges that college women aged 18 to 24 are three times as likely to be a victim of sexual violence than other women. And whereas TC3 acknowledges that college men aged 18 to 24 are 78% more likely than non-students of the same age to be a victim of rape or sexual assault. And whereas to achieve true prevention, we must move past individual responsibility and work as a community to keep our children, friends, and family safe from experiencing or perpetrating abuse through education, equality, and accountability. And whereas Take Back the Night celebrates diversity, visibility, and strength, emphasizing one's right to demand a world in which they control their own minds, bodies, and selves. Now, therefore, I, Martha Robertson, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim Wednesday, April 25th, 2018, as a day to take back the night at Tompkins Cortland Community College.
Wednesday the 25th, we are doing our Take Back the Night at Tompkins Cortland Community College. It's a march and a rally to shine the light on domestic and sexual violence. So we're really looking forward to presenting this proclamation and getting a lot of support for our event.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lindsay. Thank you for being here. And now another recognition. I will ask, is Mr. and Mrs. Ganung here? Teddy Zimrot's neighbor. I want to ask Mike Sigler and Leslie McBean Claiborne to come up and share this proclamation, a recognition. And we thank you, Mr. Ganung, for bringing this to our attention.
Come on up. I know, we hid this from you. We hid that from you. All right, we're just going to read one after another. All right. Whereas Theta Teddy Seligman Zimrot served as the investigator for and then director of the Tompkins County Human Rights Commission 1983 to 1995 in Tompkins County, New York, and whereas Teddy was the third and longest serving director of the Human Rights Department, and whereas during that time she expanded the services and staff of the office, engaged a 15-member volunteer advisory board, and provided advocacy and education to and for the Ithaca community. As early as 1994, she was actively addressing sexual harassment in the workplace, responding to complaints, educating the public, and working to resolve violations.
Okay, Ranger staff.
And?
Thank you. And whereas Teddy's passion for human rights and social justice was manifested in her genuine love for people and her ability to organize communities to fight for what is right, and whereas Teddy's many years as a social worker, lecturer, and volunteer demonstrated her deep and consistent dedication to promoting civil and human rights, social justice, and equal access to legal resources and economic opportunity for all people, regardless of their circumstances. And whereas, during her tenure as director, Teddy elevated the department and Tompkins County to a well-respected proponent of human rights, setting Tompkins County as a leader among its peers doing human rights work in New York State. And whereas one such leadership visionary example was the drafting and adoption of Local Law 6 of 1991, commonly known as Local Law C, which included sexual orientation and gender identity as a protective class under Tompkins County human rights law, and
whereas this protection did not exist in any other place in New York State, and Teddy worked relentlessly with other community leaders against lots of challenges to ensure passage of this local law. And whereas, under Teddy's leadership and because of the respect she commanded, Tompkins County was one of just a few counties that the state trusted to accept and investigate sexual harassment cases. And whereas, Teddy also served as a lecturer of Cornell's College of Human Ecology for 7 years, coordinated a New York State Audit Protective Services training program, and taught a number of classes and workshops for social services personnel. She also worked as a social worker with the Special Children's Center, now Racker Center, serving children with disabilities and their families. And whereas her volunteer activities included serving as the president of the local chapter of Adasha, the Jewish Women's Service Organization, and membership on the board, Forget About, of Tompkins County.
Now, therefore, the Tompkins County Legislature does hereby proclaim April 17th, 2018 as Theta Teddy Zimrat Day in Tompkins County. Can I just say Teddy Zimrat Day in Tompkins County? Because everybody knew her as Teddy Zimrat. And signed by Martha Robertson, chair of the Tompkins County Legislature. Hear, hear, Teddy.
Wayne, would you like to say anything? Can we put you on the spot? You were her neighbor.
All I have to say was it's Teddy would be slightly embarrassed from all this attention. And any of you that know her well, she would say thanks loads. That's what she always said. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your time. And Reverend Ken Clark from our Human Rights Office is here. Did you want to add anything about Fair Housing Month? Or can I put you on the spot, Ken? Okay, come on up. I went to a screening last night of the of a film offered by our Human Rights Office on the Fair Housing Law and the history of the law from the 1930s leading up to its passage 50 years ago. And it was really such a very, very important subject.
Well, I just wanted to, well, thank you, Martha, first of all, and I just wanted to make just a few brief comments regarding this proclamation which celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act, which was signed into law, became law on April 11th, 1968. It became law exactly 1 week to the day that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. And President Lyndon Johnson wanted to seize that moment of national tragedy to pass and to push Congress to pass this bill, which was first introduced in 1966 as a memorial to Dr. King, and seize that moment to push for the Fair Housing Bill, which turned out to be the last significant legislation of the civil rights era following the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And yet Johnson's advocacy for this landmark legislation has to be understood within the context of political and local and national activism around this bill. As I mentioned, it was first introduced in 1966 but failed to get enough votes for passage. Dr. King had been one of its most ardent supporters as one who had led open housing campaigns in Chicago in 1966, and in the last 2 years of his life spoke and wrote about fair housing as a basic human right, fair and adequate housing as a basic human right. But this effort was also strongly supported by the NAACP, the American GI Forum, and the National Committee Against Discrimination in Housing. And also, too, the two senators from Massachusetts, Senator Edward Brooke, who was the first African-American elected to the Senate since Reconstruction, and Senator Edward Kennedy, were strong supporters. Initially, the act prohibited discrimination on the basis of race, color, creed, and national origin, but in 1974 was expanded to include sex. Disability and familial status were added in 1988. And as many of us know, New York State human rights law augments the federal law by outlawing discrimination based on sexual orientation, age, and age with exceptions, marital and military status. The Fair Housing Act protects renters and buyers from discrimination by financial institution sellers or landlords and forbids the false statements that housing is unavailable and the provision of different services or facilities. And the law also prohibits the imposition of different qualifications, fees, or costs for communication or limitations or preference. The Fair Housing Amendments of 1988 also have empowered housing and urban development attorneys to bring actions before administrative law judges on behalf of victims of housing discrimination. And there have also been other changes that have been made to the law over the years to strengthen it and to expand it and to make it adapt to the times. So I'm honored to be here today to commemorate this 50th anniversary of this important landmark legislation. I think it is an example of how an attempt has been made to better perfect the Union, which is the United States, and to be able to create an environment where there can be fair housing and the type of protections under the law that enable people to live and to move toward a quality of living that all Americans should have, regardless of their distinctions or human characteristics or other identifying characteristics. So, again, thank you for this opportunity to speak to this resolution.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reverend Clark. I would note that we are a long way from having achieved that vision. We still have much, much work to do. I have just two members of the public here to speak. If anybody would like to fill out a blue form in the back and have your 3 minutes, please go ahead. The rules for public privilege, I agree to a three-minute, by signing this, I agree to a three-minute time limit. I agree not to raise my voice. I agree not to use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of the peace. I agree not to speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about the job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, I agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor. Transferring time to another person is not permitted. And I agree if I cause a disruption and am asked to leave, I will leave the chambers. I have Joe Wilson and then Robert Lynch.
Good evening. I'm Joe Wilson. No.
Joe Wilson. I live in Dryden. Many of you know that I was a high school principal here in Ithaca, and before that for 10 years in Baltimore City. I had about 1,500 students under my charge and care each of those 15 years. Before that, for between 7 to 8 years, I was one of 5 school board members in San Jose, California. There we had 60,000 students in about 35 schools. Before that I taught, before that I coached. I think I know a lot about young people, particularly when they're performing as students. I know a lot about school buildings, and I know a lot about how schools operate. The proposals to harden school sites, to arm personnel in schools, and to somehow isolate schools from the milieu in which we all live, which emphasizes, among other things, gun possession, and therefore gun use, is futile. When we send our kids to school today, when there are 300 million guns available and 300 million people, some of whom would and will do harm using guns, were playing Russian roulette with those kids. The answer is to eliminate guns in the hands of most, if not all, of us. Today's resolution, Mr. Granison's resolution, is a small step in that direction, because while it's not going to take a whole lot of guns out of the too many hands that they're already in, it is going to slow the speed with which killers can kill our kids. So I urge you to vote for this resolution, and I ask you now to take the remaining 40 seconds that I have. Close your eyes, put yourself in the cafeteria of your school or your kids' schools or your grandkids' schools, and imagine what it would be like to have automatic weapons firing in that cafeteria while young people die for their lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Robert Lynch.
Good evening. My name is Robert Lynch. I'm from the town of Enfield. And I'd like to start by quoting the late Justice Antonin Scalia in the landmark case, District of Columbia v. Heller. In case you don't remember, this was the landmark case that established the Second Amendment as a personal right to own firearms for personal protection. Like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. Yes.
From Blackstone through 19th century cases, commentators and courts routinely explained that the right was not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever, in any manner whatsoever, for whatever purpose. For that reason, I'm fully in support of Legislator Granison's resolution tonight, and I hope that you will adopt it. The Second Amendment is not an issue here. We're not talking about repealing the Second Amendment, nor are we talking about stormtroopers walking into houses and confiscating owned assault weapons from locked gun cabinets. No. We're talking about restoring the assault weapons ban that was on the books as a law of this land from about 1994 through 2004, when Congress timidly allowed it to lapse. Congress shouldn't have done that. We should put the law back on the books. The problem is we have a SAFE Act in New York State, which is fairly good. It could be strengthened, but that's not on the table tonight. But the problem is New York's borders are porous. Guns can come in from unregulated states and can be used against our school children. I don't want to see a disaster at Ithaca High School or at TC3 or at Cornell University or at Newfield High. Okay? We have to do what we can. Now, if Congress is too timid to act and do something, shame on them. But at least we, the Tompkins County Legislature, can put our position on record and tell our congressmen and senators to try to do the right thing and hope and pray that they do. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Would any other member of the public like to speak? All right. Thank you very much. I would like, are there any municipal officials here? I don't see anybody tonight. Okay. The weather's too nice. People are out, you know, playing, right? I would like to start legislative privilege just for a moment and recognize somebody who would have been 101 on April 29th. Our deepest condolences go to Mike Lane and his family on the passing of Viola Simmons Lane. I knew her from events in Dryden and from the Dryden Dairy Day parades, when she would always sit on the sidewalk and wave at us going by. We all miss her. The community that she was a part of for so very many years misses her, and Mike, you have our deepest condolences. So if we could have a moment of silence, I would like to do that. Thank you. And I want to say it's a testament, Mike, to your dedication to this job that you missed email for about 2 days, and then you were back at work. And we really appreciate and depend on that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for that, folks.
Anyone else? Amanda.
Happy birthday to Henry.
Today? Uh-oh. You ready?
Happy birthday to you.
Henry.
Happy birthday to you.
Henry.
Happy birthday, dear Henry. Happy birthday to you.
All right. Thank you, Amanda. Deborah.
So this morning, Jeff Smith took the five new legislators on the Bridges of Tompkins County tour for like 4.5 hours. And I want to thank Henry for spending his entire birthday morning with us and for spending the evening with us. And I want to thank Mary Beth Grant for letting him do that.
Absolutely. What lesson? Anybody else? Dan?
Yeah, TCAT, our bus service, is beginning a 6-month strategic planning process. And as part of that, there's going to be a public meeting Thursday, May 3rd, from 4 to 7 at the Greater Ithaca Activities Center. And there's an opportunity for the public to learn a little bit about what that means to be strategic planning for TCAT, but also mostly to give input into what people feel are the things that they want from TCAT, issues that they see, and any kind of input that they want to give. So that is Thursday, May 3rd, 4 to 7 at GIAC. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. Leslyn?
Thank you very much. Lindsay, she's probably not here still. I do want to thank her for reaching out on the proclamation for Take Back the Night, and want to remind everyone else that on the 27th, April 27th, it is Tompkins County Take Back the Night rally, which is generally organized by the Advocacy Center and a number of other community partners. So folks will be marching from Texter Hall. I think they started around 6:15 at Texter Hall up at Ithaca College, from Hull Plaza at Cornell University at around 6:30, and from GIAC at 6:45, and march to the Commons for a rally that would include speakers and performances, etc., as we all recognize and speak to the theme of this year's Take Back the Night, which is justice for Me Too. In the light of the Me Too movement, it's not just Me Too, it's more about justice for Me Too. That's the theme for this year's Take Back the Night. So I encourage everyone to please come out and be, even if you don't have a story to share, to just be there in support, because this is such an important issue for all of us. I just wanted to share that. And remind everyone, Ithaca Festival is coming up. It's not too early to start advertising for it. First weekend in June, the largest festival happening here in Tompkins County. So please stay tuned.
Thank you, Leslyn. Anyone else? Anna, Henry, Amanda.
Sorry, I'm late, everyone. I actually just wanted to do a quick shout-out for the Ithaca High School cast and crew of the production Hairspray. I know several of us here saw it, but this is a shout-out for anybody watching the video. It was phenomenal. I don't think that there was a dry eye in the house in that other one empowerment song where several of the cast members also was very, very emotional. So just thank you for your resilience. Thank you for your power. Thank you for your voice. Thank you for your dedication. And thank you for instilling in us a sense of hope. It was really powerful. So thanks.
Thank you, Anna. Henry and Amanda.
Yes, on Saturday, September 21st, from 10 to 12:30 p.m., the Southfield Neighborhood Cleanup is an annual event where Ithaca College students demonstrate stewardship of their community by doing a street cleanup of Southfield neighborhoods, from Grandview down to South Aurora Street Bridge over Six Mile Creek. 20 students will break up into two groups and sweep the area for trash. The groups will leave trash bags at the bottom of the hill for the DPW to pick up on Monday, April 23rd. This is part of the Office of Student Engagement and the Multicultural Affairs Service Saturdays program. For questions or inquiries, people can contact Don Austin, Assistant Director of Community Service at Ithaca College.
I think you said September 21st. Did you? You meant
no,
this, April?
April 21st,
right,
yes.
Right, this Saturday.
This Saturday.
Okay, thanks, Henry. Amanda?
Yeah, I just wanted to let everyone know that Sunday, the 22nd, is Earth Day. And there is a event festival going on at the space at Green Star from 12 to 6. I think for the first couple hours, there's going to be exhibitors and activities. And then starting at like 3, there's going to be music and performances. And then at the end of the day will be the People's Choice Signs of Sustainability Awards. So it's a good event. Go out, celebrate our planet.
Thank you, Amanda. Anne.
Thank you, Martha. So two things I just wanted to let people know about. This Saturday, the 21st, in honor of Earth Day, partially, is the Jacksonville Park Cleanup Day. That's Saturday, the 21st, 10 to 2. And if anybody wants to come out, and hopefully it won't be snowing, come out and help us clean out or clean up the park. We're also going to be starting a series of events where we're going to be teaching people how to, like, which invasive plants, how to identify them, how to remove them, what's the best way to do that. So we're going to be having a series of different events there throughout the summer. And then on the 26th, Thursday night at 7 p.m., in the Trumansburg Fire Hall, there's the Trumansburg Planning Board meeting, and it's a hearing on the proposed housing development at 46 South Street, as previously known as Herald Square. So if folks want to come out and talk about how we want, especially with this being Fair Housing Month, talk about how we'd like to see a really inclusive development like this happen in our county, please come out. You can also send your comments to the Trumansburg Planning Department via email. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Anna?
Sorry, I just forgot. One other event that I wanted to let people know of that is in the Fall Creek area from Court Street to Cayuga Street on April 29th from 1 to 5 p.m. is Streets Alive Ithaca. It's an amazing event. They close down the street. No cars allowed. People coming out, walking their dogs, skating, biking. It's about being active, being neighborly, creating community. So I highly recommend, if you haven't gone out before, that you come and join us. And if you go to the website streetsaliveithaca.com, and you are so inclined to help volunteer, they're still looking for volunteers. So thanks.
Great. Anybody else? All set? We are, thank you. Before I go to Jay Franklin, are there any staff waiting for a particular resolution? I don't see anybody, but is TC3. Oh, great. Okay, terrific. All right. So if you don't mind, Jay Franklin, our Director of Assessment, is going to be sharing with us some very important information about the local situation this year, but let us go to the Budget Committee, and Lesen, would you take, as Vice Chair, take the Resolution J so that we can let Lixie go home.
And Arinthia.
And Arinthia. Great.
Hello, everyone.
Hi. Introduce yourself to everybody.
Hello, everybody. I am Blixie Tate, and I am the Chief Financial Officer at Tompkins Cortland Community College, and many of you probably know me. Some of you don't. We have before you this evening a resolution to amend our child care project budget. 2 years ago, the original project was approved, and we went through the process of bidding and discovered that we had underestimated our budget by close to $1 million based on the bids. So we went back and adjusted our budget, but also secured additional funding from our generous donor, Arthur Kukas. And so we now have a modified budget for you to approve that doesn't require any additional funding on the part of the sponsors and allows us to move forward with our project in the time frame that we anticipated and move forward with providing those valuable services to our students in the community. So I'm happy to answer any questions anybody has.
All right, let's get this on the floor first. Leslie?
Yes, Madam Chair.
It's packet page 46.
Yeah, package page 46, resolution J, ID 7733, endorsing Tompkins Cortland Community College Amendment to Child Care Project, and I so move.
Seconded by Dave. All right. Thank you so much, Blixie, for being here. Is there any discussion?
Just thank you.
Well, that was quick. So it's really exciting. We're really delighted that you found a way to make this work.
So are we. So I know, Madam Chair, that there were some questions from my colleagues, and Blixie already addressed that. But in a nice little handout they gave us, the college is not asking for any funding from our county sponsors. And as she mentioned already, the local share will be funded with private dollars. And we're looking at an increase of about $732,000. Do I have that right?
You do.
Originally, it was a $4 million project. Now just $732,000 more. So.
All right. Mike?
Certainly want to acknowledge that Dr. Montague is in the audience. And here tonight, we appreciate that. This is such a tremendous step forward. We know child care is so important in Tompkins County. We often wring our hands to try to figure out how we can be helpful in that. This is bricks and mortar that will add child care beds, including infant beds, that will help staff and students, particularly at TC3, be able to further their employment, but also become better members of our society through education. So I just think this whole project has been wonderful.
Thank you, Mike. And Dr. Montague, would you like to please join us at the, you know, say a few words as well? Just, we would welcome you to our chambers and glad to have you here and delighted to support this.
Well, thank you very much. I may allow Blixie to be the presenter of the information because she has diligently worked to figure this out. We did not anticipate bids coming back so high, or else we'd have put in for $5 million originally. But I want to thank you all for your support. It's one of the things I saw early on when I started was one student handing off an infant to the other student so that they could go to class. And so the infant rooms will be just a huge addition, as Mike said, and we greatly appreciate the county's support. So thank you
so much. Leslie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think President Montague said what I wanted to say, but it reminded me of something I should have said on the privilege of the floor as well, in that, yes, child care is a huge issue, and Sudhir Hall, myself, Dr. Marguerite Ophoff, and a few other people have been working on trying to pull together a community forum with our congressional candidates to really get their take on what do they intend to do with addressing the issue of for our next generation. So this is a really good move. I don't know how much bigger it'll be than what already exists, but I'm glad that you all saw the need and is making this happen. And thanks very much to Mr. Kukas for his generosity and understanding that need as well and supporting it. So April 30th is when we're looking at that form.
I'll bet Blixie could tell us how many additional beds, or beds, additional spots, rather.
Spots.
Well, right now we have, we're going to double the number of slots we have, including two infant rooms. So we'll have a total of six rooms, where right now we only have three and we don't serve infants. So it's about 50 full-time equivalent slots, but it's going to be more than that in terms of the number of children we serve.
Fabulous. And for the record, although it is for primarily to accommodate the needs of the college students, there will be slots that might be available to the general community as well.
Absolutely. Again, our students have really the first priority, but community members are absolutely welcome if we have the space available. We do also have a sliding scale fee structure that makes the child care affordable to low-income families.
Very important.
That's terrific. I would just mention that I remember a presentation to, maybe it was the Health and Human Services Committee some years ago, where a student, TC3 student, described having to, she used the bus to get from, I think it was the west side of Ithaca, to Freeville, where her child care was, over to TC3, and then had to figure out how to also get back to Freeville by whatever the time was, deadline, hard stop, then back home again. And this is so important for all our futures. We really appreciate it. And while we're on the TC3 topic, I want to make sure everybody puts into their calendar the May 11th budget presentation. Thank you for the invitation. Come at 11:45 to get your lunch plate ready, and then from 12 to 2 or so.
For the presentation.
Very important presentation for the TC3 budget.
I just want to emphasize that this is actually taking place at our Cortland Extension Center.
Okay.
You might not have picked that up specifically in the letter, but I just wanted to make that clear. We felt that it would be helpful to be in Cortland County and recognize the folks that we're also working with in Cortland County. So I hope we can see as many people as possible from both legislatures at that meeting. Thank you.
Thank you for mentioning that. I probably would have just kind of gone right to the the usual room. All right, so Friday, May 11th. Thank you so much. Now we need to vote. Are we ready to vote? All in favor of Resolution J, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. All right. Thank you so very much. Thanks for being here. You're welcome, of course, to stay, but we understand. Jay Franklin, come on up. We're delighted to have you here tonight. We had so many questions last legislature meeting that Dan fielded very well about the state of the market, the state of the assessments and evaluations. We thought it'd be good to have you come directly.
Well, excuse me. Thanks for having me. Of course, comes April, and it's supposed to be spring of course, everyone in my house got sick, so it is. Yep. Hey, I golfed on Sunday. It is definitely spring. So thanks for having me here to explain our annual equity maintenance program. This is our 20th year being a part of an annual reassessment program. Kind of shocked me when I wrote that, that it's been 20 years that we've been maintaining and updating values to make sure that everyone is assessed at a uniform percentage of value. For the last 19 years, we've received the Excellence in Assessing Award by New York State. I believe we're the only assessing unit to receive that award all 19 years that it's been offered. And we're the only assessing unit who received it at a fraction of value. So if you remember in 2006 and 2007, we went to a triennial reassessment cycle to try that out. So we went to a 90% level of assessment, and we actually made, I think, 12,000 changes that year to keep everyone at 90% of value. And then we went to 85% and then back up to 100 at 2008. I've never heard a good reason for a fractional assessment. And I was a math major at SUNY Binghamton. I can't get to 72% unless I get to 100 first. And I haven't heard a good argument yet in my 23 years here in the business. It's just easier to explain to the public, easier for the public to understand. They can look at their assessment and ask, would I sell my house for this figure? Or will I sell my property for this figure? They don't have to go through a complex mathematical formula. Nassau County, I think, assesses at 0.25% for your class one properties. Try to explain what a $1,500 and their $1,523 assessment is. Just absolutely convoluted in my mind. We're governed by the New York State Real Property Tax Law and all of the principles out of the Appraisal Foundation. They're the congressional appointed arm that oversees USPAP, the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practices, that kind of governs all of the ethics that us appraisers have to follow. One kind of misconception that's out there is, you know, we say all property is assessed at its 100% of its market value, but it's its market value in its current use. Not its potential, not its highest and best use. There's a lot of uses or values you can determine, but we're looking at its current use. You know, I use the example up in College Town. There's an older apartment building. Based upon the income that that apartment building can produce, a willing investor would pay $1.2 million for that income stream. But if someone's going to look to buy that property, they're not going to buy that apartment building. They're going to buy the dirt, tear down that apartment building, and build something that the new zoning allows up there. So while the building may be worth $1.2 million, the dirt is probably worth, you know, $300 a square foot. So the property would probably sell for $4.8 million. We have some of the highest valued land in College Town in New York State, and that's including New York City and Long Island. If you're looking at $16, $17 million an acre for land up there, there's a pretty desirable market. For the 2018 assessment roll, we revalued the city of Ithaca, the town of Dryden in the Ellis Hollow area. We revalued the town of Lansing, except for the lake that we did last year and the village that we did two previous years, I believe. We did the town of Ithaca, the cigarette streets in Williamsburg Park, along with Cuga Heights and Saponi Meadows. We revalued apartments, office spaces, commercial development land. We also revalued all of the vacant land within the county, and then we then applied new land values to the improved properties as well. We've always focused on the total assessment. That's the figure that someone can grieve. But New York State requires us to put a land value on each parcel. I'm not entirely sure why. I know for agricultural properties, the land value is used to calculate the ag land exemption. But for other properties, you know, we'd just be fine putting $1 on it. For the 2018 roll, we made 10,770 changes out of about 36,000 parcels. 626 of those were decreases. We added about $3.7 million, or 3.7% onto the overall value of the county, so we added around $448 million. And we had a pretty quiet year in terms of informal reviews. We held 3 weeks of informal reviews. Typically, we do two. I was kind of anticipating a little more return. But we had, to date, we had about 1,031 reviews logged into our assessment database. The kind of standard for reassessments is you plan for 20% of your changes to come in. You expect 15%, but you hope for 10. Over the last 15 years, we average around 10.77% of the changes coming in. So I was anticipating around 1150. So it was a little bit under what we would have anticipated. Sorry? With making 10,770 changes, if 10% of those changes came in for an informal review, we would have saw 1,077. So we're a little bit better than even what you could hope for in terms of the parcels coming in for a review. So as of now, we're busily going through those reviews. We're looking at any areas where people came in, but maybe their neighbor didn't come in, just to make sure that not just the squeaky wheel gets the oil. We want to make sure that everyone's treated fair and equitably. And then on Monday, April 30th, we'll be filing the 2018 tentative assessment roll. At that point, any assessment changes is out of my hand. They have to be authorized by the Tompkins County Board of Assessment Review. And also, in Tompkins County, we provide for more chances for review than any other place. Mainly we do our informals, but we also hold local advisory boards of assessment review. So in our 49th year of a consolidated assessment unit, we still hold the town local advisory assessment reviews, which all of you have been appointed to. And hopefully new and old legislators will be more than welcome to come to our training session, which I believe is May 2nd.
At 9, yep.
Right in our office. We'll be holding some kind of mock grievances so you can kind of see what some property owners will come in and the type of questions that you'll get. But that's always a good time, especially for you experienced legislators who have sat through these for many years. Grievance Day is always the fourth Tuesday of May. So this year it's May 22nd. We have three hearing panels that are specialized for property owners to present their information to. That board will start taking appointments on the 30th. We take appointments from 10 to 2 with a half an hour break so we can feed our board. And then there's a first come, first serve session from 4 to 8. I always like to tell people, don't show up at 4. That's when everyone else is showing up. You know, come at 6 and you can probably get right in and be seen. So that's kind of my brief overview. If questions, more than happy to answer.
Thanks very much, Jay. First, I think we use the word returning legislators rather than old.
I said experience when I corrected myself.
Experience,
sorry.
That's good too. That's good. Would you just tell people just take a second and tell folks about your dad?
Well, my dad he actually came to this county as a part of Clemenshaw, though it did a revaluation back in the mid-60s for us. And then he said, let's stick around here. So he became the town of Ithaca assessor in the 60s. When we consolidated at the assessment office, he became the assistant director at that time. And then in 86, he was promoted to director, retired in 96 in April, and I started in the office in 97. So at least it's been run right at least for 49 years of our 49 and a half years, kind of within there. But it's, you know, this is a family business. My brother is also a fee appraiser, working for a private company whose job is to fight the assessor down on Long Island. So it makes for good conversation. I can ask him how he looks at something. So somehow we all followed my dad into drawing with highlighters, is what we used to say back in the day with him.
Thank you very much, Jay. Mike, Lane, and then Leslie.
Jay, could you mention about the changes to the STAR enhanced program under the new state legislation that just got passed?
Yeah. Included in the signed budget, all property owners who receive the enhanced STAR are now going to have to register with New York State. New York State will now be the ones who will verify a property owner's income and their eligibility, and then they will notify my office that a person is eligible for the enhanced STAR. I was just on a conference call last week. It appears New York State is going to require everyone to re-register for the income verification program. So about 4,700 property owners in New York State are going to have to go to a webpage on New York State, put in their Social Security, numbers and allow New York State to try to verify their income, which is all good for people who file a New York State income tax. The burden is going to be on property owners who do not have to file a New York State income tax return. At that point, they will have to provide some sort of documentation of their income to New York State. New York State is under the assumption that they'll be able to check Social Security, check W-2s, and somehow create an income for people who don't have to file an income tax return. I'm very skeptical that can happen. I know we have at least 700 people that we track in our office that do not file an income tax return. We take their Social Security statements, their bank statements, really whatever they have in order for us to verify their income. Now, these same people who don't file an income tax return, like for the 2018 assessment roll, they would have to provide their 2016 income documents to New York State to be verified for the enhanced STAR. Then they'd have to come to my office and provide their 2017 income so I can qualify them for our low-income senior exemption. It's going to be very confusing. Once we hear more, there's more discussions with a small group of us assessors and county real property tax directors to hopefully it won't be the debacle that the initial year of the STAR check credit program was. Hopefully we'll have more information as they come out, but we're going to have a PR campaign to make sure that nobody falls through the cracks.
Sounds great. Thank you, Jay. Leslin?
So that was partly what I wanted to ask, Jay, and I was going to comment that the whole legacy of your family, it's either a legacy or a real clandestine operation. But it seems like the enhanced STAR is more of a clandestine operation. Thank you for explaining that. That's what I wanted to find out about. So what I'm hearing from you is that you get more information. We'll get more information, and you'll do your best to make sure that those who might be affected will understand this better, because things coming out of the state are not always very clear. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm very worried about the people who don't file an income tax, but also the people who float back and forth from an enhanced STAR to a basic, depending on where their income, and I've already notified New York State that they need a mechanism for the local assessors to notify the state that here's this group of people that we typically track as enhanced STAR people, but this year they may not have gotten it because they didn't file, their income was too high, and that they need to register with New York State.
Okay, I've got Mike Sigler, and then Anna, and then Ann.
I asked you this question at the meeting, but we were trying to get through that one. And since you're here, I'll ask it here. So I bought a house last year on Court Street. And I paid X amount, and of course it's been reassessed now to the price that I paid, which makes a lot of sense, right? Is the house and the land reassessed at that point? I mean, that's everything, right?
The house is the house isn't reassessed when you purchase it. The house is reassessed when we revalue that area.
Okay.
So one sale doesn't make the market, but when we revalue the city of Ithaca, we'll look at all those houses and look at their total assessment at that time.
Okay. So my house basically set the market then, because mine went up, so clearly we reassessed that part of the mm-hmm. city. So my purchase then set the market of what land was worth then, I guess, in that area. Is that correct?
What the building was worth, yes. Okay. What that type of
but
unit
not the
is
land.
Worth. Correct.
So the
when
is left out, or?
Well, when you bought your house, I assume you didn't say, I'll pay you $52,000 for the land and $148,000 for the total, so I'll give you $200,000 for it.
Right.
Correct. So you look at, in the same way that we look at it, is what's that property going to sell for? The state requires us to put a land value on each and every parcel, so we try on improved properties to make it realistic. In the past few years, we haven't had the time or the staff to update land values on improved properties. So this year, we did have that staffing in order to make that update. So we tried putting a realistic land value on each improved property.
Okay, but we derive basically all our value from the actual house or the building or the whatever is above ground, basically. Okay.
But do you... So if you did that for the whole city, as you said, is it a different land value for each parcel, or you sort of say, okay, and a lot in the city is going to be X amount, and the total, you're taking the total value is and subtracting.
What we did is we created a land table. So we looked at Fall Creek and said the typical neighborhood in Fall Creek is, and of course, the typical neighborhood in Fall Creek is 47 by 102 is what that typical lot would be. And then we said, all right, the average assessment in Fall Creek is going to be, you know, somewhere around $230,000. So a realistic land value would be 25% of that overall value. So it's going to be around $57,000 is what a typical land would be in order to support a house of that value. We then looked at some of the sales. A lot of the neighborhoods we didn't have sales in. So it's kind of hard to create a land value, but we wanted to make it more realistic. So we kind of built a land table that would fit that type of lot, but then adjustments would have to be made if there's more frontage, if there's less depth, if there's more depth. But when we go to value that property, we do look at the lot, but we're also looking at how that lot compares to a lot that's sold and making any adjustments to that sale price to that. So it's not a land value plus house value plus garage value equals total value.
Okay, thank you very much. Ann, then Anna. Anna, then Ann. I'm sorry.
We're really going to make this harder than this year. We're going to make nicknames.
All right. Kellis and then Corman.
That's how it works. AK, that makes it even worse. A couple things. One, it was an addition to the questions that Mike had and Leslin had. The Board of Elections went right at the end of this last year, created like an instruction manual, very clear step-by-step of how people could get their 2017 property tax. It was, I don't know if everybody remembers that, but it was very helpful for people because it is a very complicated situation. And I'm thinking this, no matter how much you explain it, is going to be exceptionally complicated. If there was some way to create instructions of these are the steps you will need, don't forget these two, that we could publish, that we could all share, that would be crazy helpful. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, I don't know if it's as easy as that or if there's something you could create instructions for.
Yep. Once we hear how New York State's actually going to administer it, you know, we already have around 2,700 people signed up for the income verification program. So New York State already has their Social Security numbers. They already verify their income each and every year for us. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping New York State wouldn't make them jump through hoops again to re-register. But on my phone call last week, I think they're going to start from scratch and go ahead and re-register. Yeah, but once we get it, once we know what's going to go on, you know, we'll try to make it as easy. And, you know, we have phone numbers, we have emails, so we'll track who hasn't registered with New York State and we'll track them down like we do to get them to apply.
And then walk them through it.
Correct.
Any way we can help out. And the other question was just a review. Two questions. The 3.7% increase in value over the county that you've seen, is that standard? Is there a trend? Is that abnormal or is that low, high? Yeah,
it's a little bit on the higher side. It'll probably translate to a 4.5-5% tax base increase. There wasn't a lot of... This was a year I didn't revalue Cornell, so you won't see a big jump in wholly exempt properties. So a lot of that increase will go as a higher percent on a lower tax base, if that made any sense. So you'll see a little more. It was a more active year. It wasn't as active as the crazy years of 2003, 2004, and 2005, but it was more active than 17, 16, 15.
And then this is a review question. You base what you revalue or the segments that you revalue based off of a percentage. If there's like 10% sales in a certain area, that triggers. What triggers you evaluating?
We do a pretty in-depth statistical analysis. We look at properties that have sold. We take that sale price, compare it to our assessment, and come up with a assessment to sale ratio. And then when that ratio dips away from one or increases above one, those are areas that we know we have to go in. Sale prices aren't tracking along with our assessments. And, you know, we used to make a 3% trend. There's not a lot of difference between a $103,000 house and a $100,000 house. You know, we would like to make that sort of trend, but there's more static in this real estate market than 3%. So we do typically wait to get on the north side of a 5% variation to at least go out and revalue that area.
Thanks. Ann Corman.
Thank you, Martha. And thank you, Jay, for the presentation. I was trying to look up what the cigarette streets are, and the only thing I could find a reference to was that there are cigarette streets, and I didn't have time to look up. Do we have Virginia Slims, Marlboro Streets?
Salem,
Muriel, Tarrington.
Muriel?
That's yeah, Winston. Yep.
Oh, okay.
They're
kind of kind of bordered by Hanshaw and Warren Road.
Okay. Thank you. And then the other question I had was, I can't find the original email with the assessment department training for the assessment review that us younger, vibrant, I'm sorry, the less experienced legislators definitely want to go to. On the second, I just have it starts at 9. I think it's over at your department.
It's over in my office, yep.
But I don't have the ending time, for instance.
It probably takes about an hour and a half.
Okay.
Maybe 2 hours is kind of what I'd plan and be pleasantly surprised. It really is dictated by the number of attendees and the stories that prior members of that advisory board tell.
Thank you.
Henry?
Jay, thank you for your presentation. I still have a question about buying houses and then changing them over to a rental house. Mm-hmm. If you buy a house on South Hill and it's a family to family, you may go over $250,000. If it's going from to a rental place, it may go for $350,000.
Mm-hmm.
How is that incorporated in the assessment? Is it just the ratios, or how do you adjust for that? And that house sold, but then another house sold for only $250,000.
Mm-hmm. That's a tough question that we struggle with. And it's easier in a place like Fall Creek, where it's not as changing over to a rental market as opposed to a owner-occupied market. And it's not as easy as up in the outskirts of College Town, where that single-family house will sell as a rental property. So when we're looking at rental properties compared to owner-occupied properties, we have to really look at what their physical condition is and make adjustments based upon that. Typically, some of those $330,000 sales, it's not being supported by the income that they can produce, but it may be influenced by a potential future use of that property. So that $330,000 sale isn't really value in use. It's has some highest and best use component to it.
So they're able to put another house on it, for example, if they're able to do that grandma apartment or whatever, and split the house into a duplex?
Correct. Yeah. Or be able to add another unit upstairs or something along that line, subdivide the property and add another duplex to it. So those sales we don't use when they're not based upon its current use of the property. You know, the same, we wouldn't use the $4.8 million sale in College Town that's for the dirt to value the income-producing properties. Now, the when you look at sales, that calibrates your income approach to value. So when you look at, we know what income that property can produce, we know what expenses are, so we get a net income. And when you look at what that net income will translate into a sale price, that determines what's called the capitalization rate. You know, what a willing buyer will use in order to determine what they're willing to spend in order to get that income stream back. They'll look at the risk of the property and be able to take that future stream of revenue and bring it back into today's dollars. So they're really one in the same, but the hard part is making sure that you're comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges.
And how do you know when someone purchases a house that it's being converted?
Well, one of the big tasks that my office does is sales verification. So we call up the buyer, the seller, we can't get a hold of them, we call up the attorney, the listing agent, and we'll say, why did this one sell for X? You know, what's going on? Oh, they're looking at the back of the property, they want to build a duplex. We know who the buyers are that typically do things like that. You know, we look at where did the buyer come from? Are they out of town? Are they just moving from Dryden to the city of Ithaca? To really look to see, do they know the market? Do they know what the area is? Just so that we can make sure that we're making good, valid comparables. And then, you know, along with doing that sales verification, we also ask people, why'd you buy here? You know, the property was listed for a week, you know, and you bought, and it sold for $10,000 more than the listing price. What went into that? And then we find out that, oh, there was seven bidders on the property, and this was what I was willing to go to.
Like 90% of everything now. Okay. Shauna?
Hey, Jane. Thanks for your presentation. I know I was one of the individuals that reached out to you after receiving my own assessment bill. And we had a nice conversation. And, you know, at this point, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse that I received one of the highest increases in Northeast, because at least whenever constituents call me, they don't feel as bad, knowing that mine's about triple than theirs. But one thing that I think we discussed that I think is important for people to understand is that it's not just a flat increase for the area, that it is based on a variable amount of factors. And one thing that Jay also offered was that if there are people that do have concerns, for them to get a hold of your office and you can talk them through certain things. We did discuss how I have a neighbor, an elderly neighbor who's struggling, and there might be some programs that she might be eligible for that she might not have signed up for. So thank you for offering that. And I appreciate it.
And that's one, you know, we try to find reasons to reduce a value when someone comes in. You know, if they come in and start saying taxes are too high, the 12 people in my office will all say, yep, we all agree with you, taxes are too high, but let's focus on your value. Now let's get down to your inventory. You know, is this correct? How's the condition of your property? Have you renovated? How's your land? Is it steep? Is it wet? Kind of give us something to work with. You know, we don't work on commission here. You know, it really doesn't matter really where values go to us. I just want to make sure that everyone's fair and equitable. We'll never defend a wrong value, but we will defend a correct value. And one metric that I always look at is how many people who came in for our informals take that next step to the grievance procedure. Because if they come in for an informal, I want them to either understand this is why we did what we did, or we'll be able to take their concerns and be able to make that reduction. And that percentage has kind of dipped down over the last 8 years, 9 years or so.
Yeah, and there's always good advice, like, you know, or things happen at our, when we do the board of assessments, you know, the local boards, people might come in with a newer appraisal or a new sale or something. So they're definitely always open to new information. I think, for example, the posting on Facebook of your daughter painting your bathroom, you don't know how much that costs you, Shauna. So, Jay, a couple questions. One, the 3.69% increase, am I to understand that's not new lumber, that's the increase in the current existing base?
Correct. I haven't taken a look at new lumber. That's going to be somewhat influenced. There's a lot of IDA projects this year, and that kind of goes into the wholly exempt kind of realm, so unfortunately we'll miss out on that since IDA new lumber doesn't count towards our tax-based growth factor.
Okay. And I was hesitating after Henry's round of questions because I was trying to absorb it all, and I'm hesitating, but I think I want to ask you to help us understand condominium taxation as you did yesterday at the Housing Committee, because I know I won't be able to explain it. So If you can give us a couple sentences, a little bit of explanation of how that works.
Real property law 339Y allows or requires each assessor to value a condo project as a whole. So we almost value it as an apartment building, and then we divvy up the individual units assessment based upon the offering plan or however it's defined, either within that offering plan or by the developer. I always say if I put somebody in Savannah Park or Lansing West, you wouldn't know which development that you were in. So as a bricks and mortar valuation, just simply because Savannah Park is a condo and Lansing West is an apartment, they shouldn't have differing valuations. That's kind of the basis behind Real Property Tax Law 339Y. The newest condo project that we have that's open, the Lehigh Valley House, I have to assess those units at $168,000 per unit, but they'll sell somewhere between $300,000 and $350,000. So we have to look at what would Lehigh Valley House rent out, similar to the unfinished furniture store that got converted to apartments. So we say, all right, those are really one in the same. So what would it rent? What would the Lehigh Valley House be as an apartment building? And then we divvy up those units. So there is a lot more buying power in a condo. And one thing, condos is a form of ownership. It's not a building style. So you would look at it and see, yep, that's an apartment building or a condo. But you could have a condominium be kind of like Lake Watch or East Lake. You know, a 4,000 square foot home on 5 acres could be owned in a condominium form of ownership. Luckily, we don't have that type of scenario here. You know, to me, if it looks and acts like a condo, which to me it's in a cluster in a multi-level house, then the provisions of 339Y should be applicable. If you get into a single-family house development, then that's kind of stretching it.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Well, Jay, I think we can see why you've received the Excellence in Assessing Award for 19 years. This is really such a professional operation and such a rational program, and I think that's why people come in with complaints. Not as many of them come back, you know, in the subsequent stages of grievance. We really appreciate the work that you and all your staff do. So thanks very much for explaining things so well for us tonight.
Thank you. I have 11 very good people in my office that make the 12th person look very good. So I get to come here and take all the accolades, but it's really them who provide that service. You know, when a senior comes into our office, Tammy knows exactly who that person is. She's dealt with them for 20 years, 15 years that she's been there. It's, you know, when seniors come in, I don't know what I'm going to do in 16 years when I'm around, when those seniors move on. You know, I'm going to have to meet a whole new group of people and show pictures of my kids to them, but you know, that's kind of the fun part of the year is seeing them come in and seeing that we can help them. But I owe it all to the people in my office and to you all to provide me with the funding and the support and also, quite frankly, to stay out of my hair. And unlike other assessors who unfortunately are heavily influenced by their town boards, you know, in the 49 years that Franklin's been in the office, we've never been influenced by any politician, school board member, anybody, and that's probably the greatest part of my job.
Can you please repeat that? I'm serious, because I think people really do believe that we are pulling the strings behind a lot of things, and we're not. So I appreciate that a lot. Sorry, Mart, I jumped in the middle of that because it was just so profound.
Well, you go back to my dad. When my dad got interviewed for the town of Ithaca assessor job, the town supervisor came in and said, "What would you do if I asked you to change an assessment?" And my dad said, "Well, thank you for allowing me to work with you, but I resign."
He didn't promise honest loyalty.
No, and I'm so glad that I've never had to do that.
Thank you so much, Jay. We really appreciate all you said. Very good. Excellent. That's a hard act to follow. Thank you, but I guess I'll go for it. So a couple of things in my report. You have heard me talk about the non-pipe alternatives RFP through NYSEG. I think we have not had a chance to let you know that the deadline for applications has been extended to May 1st. Through efforts by our group that's been working on this, Anna and me, Katie Borghella, Irene Weiser, Ken Schlatter, Bert Bland, in conversation with the Department of Public Services staff, they really understood our concerns and about the RFP, and they got NYSEG to extend the deadline. We had another call today with them and with NYSEG, kind of looking ahead to after May 1st, what happens. How are they going to decide on proposals? And we had, I think, a really good conversation. It's pretty clear that the DPS staff has some of the same concerns that we do, but for the moment, it's a wait and see. NYSEG promised to give a quick, within a month, response to DPS and to us. High-level kind of, well, we got this many responses, this many are geothermal, this many are, you know, efficiency, this many are something else, and just give us a sense of what kind of response they got. If it seems not really adequate to do the job kind of response, then it feels we are going to be part of re-evaluating and sort of rewriting, redesigning the process. So I felt pretty good about the call today. Some folks were able to join. I think Henry and Shauna were at different parts of the charrette last week that Cornell held on East Hill Village, about the big, and there may have been other people at different parts of the meetings too, that had a week-long series of meetings. Looks really very exciting for a real rejuvenation, a real redevelopment of the whole East Hill Village area on both sides of Pine Tree Road. I will say that the path down Pine Tree Road that we rebuilt is really going to turn out to be a pivotal connector to Cornell, to what's going to be probably hundreds more people living in that neighborhood, and to create a real vibrant economic center with a lot of housing, of mixed income, mixed, we hope, mixed kind of ownership, and mixed use. Child care center is on the map, as well as they have promised to incorporate into the designs of the first floor units the kinds of things that would enable those units to become family daycare homes. So it felt like a really exciting development. I would be remiss if I didn't mention Henry's concern about traffic. But yeah, there are going to be traffic impacts, and they're certainly going to be looking at that. And there's a long way to go, but it looks really exciting. There was a NYSAC webinar today on the state budget. I don't know if anybody else listened in on some of it. I was able to listen to a couple, you know, a half of it or so. If I can mention just a couple things. There is apparently I may have some details wrong, but $100 million new annually on opioid programs, including $4 million for substance abuse disorder treatment in jails. Now, $4 million doesn't go very far statewide, but it sounds like there's at least a little pocket there for treatment in jails. There was conversation about the shared services plan. Remember, we had to do a plan with all the municipalities last year. We are going to be required to convene that panel at least twice each year from now 2021. So that's something that we assume Jason will be revving up again. In indigent legal services, there was additional money that went from $104 million last year to $155 million this year. That's a pretty big jump to expand for all counties some of the things that we already do ourselves, such as counsel at arraignment. We already do that, but they are going to extend that for all counties. Sexual harassment policies, there are some new regulations and policies put into place in particular for all employers, so as an employer, we will have to take a hard look at that and make sure that we're meeting new requirements as far as training and bidding, et cetera, a number of things related to that. New money on workforce development programs, but in particular, I already bumped this over to Jason about transportation and other capital funding programs. There's the SAM grant, which is, I can't remember the initial, what it stands for, but I think that's the program under which Barbara Lifton got us $500,000 for the Tompkins Center. They've put more money, $90 million of new money into that program, and it's basically member item money. Remember member items? They're back. So these will be especially championed by individual legislators, so I already asked Jason that we're going to start working on a project list, and I'm going to, Jason, I'm meeting with Santi Myrick and Dan Kogan tomorrow, and TCAT is going to be one of the things on that list as a beginning conversation. So those are just some tidbits out of the state budget that I thought I would share. And I have a couple of chair appointment, the Workforce Development Board, Kit Kephart, to be a member there. So are there any questions on any of that? All right. Thank you very much. Jason Molino, County Administrator.
Thank you very much. Nothing too in-depth to report. Jonathan did bring up the changes in the sexual harassment policy requirements, so we'll be looking at that over the next few months along with some other policies as well, to any changes to bring forward through its adoption process. Other than that, right now we're in the middle of preparing for the budget retreat next week. Excuse me. Kevin and I have been working feverishly over the past week to get things in line. So, that's all.
Thanks, Jason. Any questions? Just one I have on the Tompkins Center, the History Center.
Yes.
Tompkins Center. Do we have a closing date for that, or is that still in the works?
You know, I don't believe. That's a good question for Jonathan, I guess.
Nice.
I don't know. The Tompkins Center.
That was smooth.
Do we have a closing date?
Yes.
We have an approximate but not an exact closing date because we are waiting for them to decide exactly when they are moving.
Okay. Rich?
I did see an email come out from the trust company indicating they are moving their main branch into the new building. Their teller is on the 15th of May. So it's probably close to that.
Okay, great.
Right, but that's not the final of moving everything out.
So. Okay, right. And if I can put somebody on the spot again, the old library, have we closed on that?
That I don't know. I can get back to you. I don't know if that question.
I thought we've closed, right?
Yeah.
Mike?
We're closed, but there's a couple of payments due us. Isn't that correct?
Right. That's right. Yeah. We closed, I think it was December 31st.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Jonathan Wood, County Attorney.
Okay. I'm not going to be able to go with no report again because the chair asked me to give a little background on the hydro and say a few things about that. But I do wanted to follow up on the sexual harassment policy, which both Martha and Jason mentioned. Under the budget, the Department of Labor is supposed to create a model policy, and then all employers have to adopt the policy or have a policy which is at least as protective. So I think before we do anything, we have to wait for the model policy to come out. And who knows when that will actually come out. But it's something we will work on, but we kind of have to wait for the model policy before we actually adopt the policy. So turning to the subject of the hydro plant. Gravity sent out invitations, and please respond to them. They think they sent it out again today to members of the legislature. So if you could please respond so they'll know who's coming. Hopefully you can all come. I think you'll enjoy it. So I wanted to give a little background on the history of the and how we came to have this hydro plant. But just a reminder, it's 10 to 12 next Thursday, not this coming Thursday, but the 26th. It's up in Waterloo. And there'll be probably about an hour of, or maybe probably a little less, but a few people speaking, both from Gravity and from Mega, and Martha will have a few words just to talk about the history. There'll be a short dedication honoring Stu Stein's contribution to the project. And then, probably most importantly, there will be tours of the facility, probably breaking up in groups of about 10. And the facility is really worth seeing, so and it's educational if you've never been to hydro plant. So I encourage people to come. But I did want to kind of give a brief history of how we came to be associated with this hydro plant and just what it is. So it kind of starts with sort of the history of Mega, which I'll explain. So I believe it was in 1998 that the state deregulated the purchase of electricity, which basically meant that counties and others could buy electricity, the commodity, separate and apart from the transportation of electricity. Prior to that, you just got it from the utility. So at that time, and Stu Stein was the chair, the legislature had this idea that maybe if we combine with some other entities and we bid together, and we'd have a greater quantity of need and we'd get a better price. So the county joined back then with Tioga County and we bid together and we got a good price. The idea became kind of popular with other municipalities. They wanted to know if they could join. And so we formed the corporation, Municipal Electric and Gas, Inc., which was designed to allow different municipalities, more than just us and Tioga, to join in and bid together. Right now we have, I think, 285 municipalities that are, it varies from time to time, but it's been a pretty successful corporation, and several people from the county worked for it, Stu Stein until he passed away. Barbara Blanchard still does, and Jennifer Liu and I both still work for Vega. Obviously part-time. But in any event, in addition to just bidding for electricity and for gas, Mega has expanded to provide other services to municipalities. And without going into all the other services, one of the most important other services was to try to get into renewable energy. I think it was in late 2011, New York State amended the public service law to allow entities, including counties, to what they call remote net meter. from renewable energy plants, and it's a little kind of complicated concept, but if you can have an energy plant, either solar or hydro or wind, which produces 2 megawatts of electricity or less, you can pay for all the electricity that that plant produces and then get a deduction on your electric bill for the amount that you paid. It's not exactly, the rates are different, it's a little more complicated than that, but essentially you can then contribute to the production of renewable energy and get a credit on your electric bill for it. So Mega, in combination with the county, did a bid for companies to help us do this. And we got a solar company as well as a hydro company. The hydro company is Gravity Renewables out of Boulder, Colorado. We have several solar projects, but that's apart from this. Gravity does hydro projects. So as soon as we did the bid and we got Gravity as the best bidder for hydro projects, the county tried to make an arrangement with Gravity so we can get a hydro project which would be devoted to Tompkins County. There are certain rules. It has to be in your electric zone. It has to be the same utility. So it's, you know, it's a challenge, and then it has to be 2 megawatts or less. So we were able, Gravity was able to find us a facility in Waterloo, which actually fits perfectly for remote net metering. So we entered into an agreement with Gravity, whereby we buy all the electricity that this facility generates, and then we get a deduction for each kilowatt that we buy on our electric bill. Now, this, again, is complicated because we have 25 different electric bills for many different buildings. But basically, we pay Gravity for what they produce, and in return, we get a deduction on our electric bills. We also get to claim the environmental attributes of the production, so it reduces our carbon footprint in a real way. And we actually get certificates quarterly saying how much we've produced. So to kind of give you just kind of an idea, the facility, the county uses about 6 million kilowatts a year for all our facilities together, including the airport, et cetera. And this facility, we estimate, would produce about 3.8 million a year, which would be about 63% of the county's electricity or electric needs. So we would pay them for that 63%, and then we would get a deduction from on our electric bill. In fact, this past year, they produced 4.747 million kilowatt hours, which is about 80% of our electric bill. So it works out to be a great deal for us for a lot of reasons. Number one, we get to produce all this electricity through hydro. And the hydro facilities are... the facility is existing, but one of the great things, there are two really great things about hydro, is one is there's a lot of hydro plants which are like ending their useful life and they don't last forever. And so either you invest in them, you find someone to invest in them and improve them, or they go off the grid. So it's real important to try to identify these things and reinvest in them to keep them on the grid. And then not only don't they go off the grid, but they improve and make generate more electricity. And the second thing is that under the law, you could only do so much, like 2 kilowatts, 2 megawatt facility. And without getting into detail of what a megawatt is that if you have a hydro facility, you can produce a lot more electricity for 2 megawatts than you could with, say, a solar facility or a wind facility. And that's basically 2 megawatts is the capacity of a plant, and whereas the sun only shines a certain percent of the time and the wind only blows a certain percentage of the time, water flows a lot more regularly. So for our 2 megawatts, we get to produce, in this case, 80% this past year of our electric needs, where you'd never be able to do that, even come close with solar. So it turns out to be a great deal. And another way it's a great deal, it's also that for 20 years, the 20-year period of the agreement, we basically effectively are able to lock in a price which protects us if electricity goes up. We're basically protected for that because we have a set price, and then we are remote net meter. We get a deduction equivalent to current pricing. So it essentially hedges against price increases in electricity for the next 20 years. So it's a really good deal, and it's a good thing to see. You should come and see the hydro plant, and I'm not sure what else to say, but happy to answer any questions.
That's really helpful. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Deborah?
Thank you for that, Jonathan. I remember sitting through those meetings like last year or so, wondering what on earth you were talking about. But I'm not clear. We don't actually have to use their electricity. We just pay them to produce it and feed it into the...
Right. So the plant produces electricity, and that electricity goes into the grid up there in Waterloo. We pay them based on the meter up there in Waterloo. So we don't actually use that electricity. However, in truth is, when you buy electricity, you're never really using the electricity right. that you buy. We then take electricity off the grid here, and of course it all kind of combines, so you can't really, it's like money, you can't really identify this electron is from there. So we basically pay for what goes on the grid there, and then we get a deduction for that, and then we take off the grid here.
So we're subsidizing the production of electricity from a renewable source.
Yes.
Thank you.
And what you said before about making the investment to renew the facility, to bring it up to, you know, modern operations is critical. Now, we're not just buying electricity that was already flowing. We're not just buying hydropower that was already going. Our investment and our 20-year agreement enabled Gravity to make that investment for the future. Otherwise, I mean, somebody else might have bought it, but...
Right. Yeah, and you'll see a lot of those improvements. Basically, in order to keep its license from FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which licenses hydro plants, a lot of improvements had to be made because the facility was deteriorating and would have lost its license eventually, like most of them will, if not rejuvenate. But you'll see a lot of the improvements. Some of the improvements, the fish passage area is much improved, so fish. There's a rake, which is actually been installed in the past couple of months, which rakes things up. And one of the biggest improvements these days in hydro facilities is basically the electronic circuitry, so that and I'm not even sure I fully understand and explain, but so that you judge the flow of water electronically in a way so that you maximize the production of electricity from the same amount of water, which 100 years ago they didn't have, but now they have. So it enables a hydro plant to be more efficient.
Great. Terrific. Something to be proud of. Anybody, any other questions? All right. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Appreciate that. Let's all think of what we're going to ask Jonathan to report on next time, because this is fun.
Well, you're on a roll.
On a roll.
Yeah, lose my reputation.
The quiet man.
Rick Snyder, finance director.
Take out a sheet of paper. We're going to have a test now on what Jonathan just said. I have no report tonight, just to mention to you that we did start our county audit today, and we're very busy. That's it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rick. All right. Are there any resolutions to be added to or with Henry?
Can I ask Rick a question?
Yeah, of course.
Regarding the investment policy that's attached, to the, I was wondering, I mean, how much, I was thinking about in terms of fossil fuel funding and everything else. How much of the assets, how much of the cash management policy really comes to that? I know lots of things are in short-term sales. Lots of CDs, lots of other deposits in banks, but I was wondering how much of the funding is used for other long-term securities.
We have zero in stocks, okay. In any stocks, because we're prevented from being in what, like, pension funds would be in with a lot of stocks and bonds and things that, or derivatives or things like real estate, because we have to fall under a certain governmental regulation that the state provides. And in that very strict application of what the state allows, municipalities being all, we have very plain vanilla investments. So you won't find the county or any of its agencies being involved in stocks, the stock market, or any of those things that you're thinking of there. In the past few years, since interest rates have been so low, we're basically in a lot of money market accounts because there hasn't been a real rate of return that would lead us to go out and do a lot of investments. As interest rates tick upward and there are more options available now, the things that you might see us investing in, and it's all mentioned here in the policy, is CDs and maybe treasury bills and things of that nature. But right now it's been very, very plain. And while you brought the investment policy up, it came up at the budget committee meeting. There's absolutely no change in this investment and cash management policy from what was offered before. We're just required to bring it to you every year so you can say you've reviewed it.
Any other questions for Rick? For Rick? All right, thank you. Are there any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? I've got Dave first.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to pull Resolution B.
All right, and Rich?
Thank you, Martha. I would like to add what's marked as Resolution K, a resolution in support of New York State legislation establishing a third county court judge in Tompkins County.
All right, is there a second to add that to the agenda? Mike Lane? All in favor of adding this to the agenda? Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you. So that will go. We can do that under public safety report. Would you like to do that?
Yes.
Okay. Great. All right. Then I will go ahead with the consent agenda. If you have anything to you'd like discussed, please just let us know. Resolution A, amendment to Resolution Number 39 of 2018 to modify Public Health Department fiscal target for medical examiner program restructuring, ID 7735. And Resolution C, adoption of cash management and investment policy, ID 7719. Appointments to the Advisory Board on Indigent Representation, John Fitzgerald and Henry Granison. Stop DWI Advisory Board, Najoku Awa. To the Community Mental Health Services Board Substance Abuse Subcommittee, GP Zarenda and Daniel Sedolovsky, MD. And to the Public Information Advisory Board, Bruce Ryan. I have a motion on the consent agenda. Moved by Leslin and seconded by Anna. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. All right. Thank you very much. For committee reports, let's start with Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee. Leslie McBean Claiborne, Chair.
The Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee will meet next Wednesday, 3:30, Old Jail Conference Room. The main topic in our agenda is we will hear from the folks at the City of Ithaca on the diversity toolkit for the CTAP. We'll be discussing that.
Okay. Thank you, Leslie. Any questions? All right. For the Housing Committee, we met yesterday, and we had most of the time spent on condominium development, as Jay Franklin went into further detail on condos, and in particular on kind of some of the barriers and the structural problems with creating condominium developments in Tompkins County, or I guess in upstate, in New York, period. We also heard a brief update from Adam Bronfen, a Cornell University Planning Department senior who's been working on this topic. He's going to be giving us a fuller report next month. So really trying to dig into this issue. And we've got a memo from Jay. I think it only went to committee members, but we can certainly forward that to other folks if you're interested. He told us some of what he said tonight about Real Property Law 339Y. But another thing that we spent time on is the idea that the Attorney General of the state has to approve the offering plan, and that's for each unit. So if you're doing a condo development for 100 units, you have to do 100 different offering plans, and it's enormously tedious and time-consuming. And, you know, if you're just doing a four-unit project or a 600-unit project, it's kind of the same level of difficulty and burden, really. The financing is also very difficult. You have to pre-sell 50% of the units in any development, so that can be very hard in this development. So in a sense, it seems sort of very short version of, to me, it seemed like there are high barriers to entry, but there's real benefit to the owner of the condo unit. If you can get through those barriers, there's real benefit because the property taxes are significantly lower than if you're in an apartment or a house of similar value. That also leads to some questions about whether, in fact, we as a taxing jurisdiction want to really encourage that, because then that means that somebody else is picking up the taxes on that value that's not available. So it merits a lot of really serious consideration, even if there's anything that we could do to facilitate condo development, and in what forms, how much do we want to do. So nothing simple, right? We heard from Tierra Labrada, who manages the continuum of care on housing development, and she gave us a report on the point in time count, which is the yearly HUD-mandated count of homeless people, unsheltered people in our county. And just a couple of quick notes that she talked about the coordinated assessment, where we have one assessment intake form that all the housing providers use. And the point in time count identified, it was in January, 46 individuals in our county were identified as homeless that night. We are doing, I think, an excellent job on moving people into housing, into supportive housing, once they're on that list, the coordinated assessment list. So, and then Megan McDonald gave us a report on things that are going on in the office in housing. New housing planner will be coming in May, and they expect to be able to bring to the committee in May or maybe June a more detailed work plan for how they're going to move forward on implementation of the housing strategy. So that's a summary of what we talked about yesterday. If there are any questions or additions. Okay, thank you very much. Next committee is Public Safety Committee, Rich John.
Thank you, Martha. I was not at the Public Safety Committee meeting. I was traveling out of town, so I appreciate my colleague and Vice Chair Henry Granison covering for me. I will process some resolutions, but then I'll turn the floor over to Henry to report on the meeting. I would move Resolution D, resolution to authorize the county administrator to execute the Memorandum of Understanding to participate in the Raise the Age Compliance Coalition.
Is there a second? Seconded by Henry. Any discussion? I had a question about our representative. Was it identified as on this coalition? Has that person been identified?
I think that's up to Jason to
You're going to do it?
Yeah. Generally, this came about from primarily administrators talking about trying to pool resources. So either I would be attending those meetings or Pat or Kit.
Great. Anything else? Ready to vote? All in favor, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous.
And Resolution E, enhancing safety of county facilities through provision of naloxone. And I would move it.
Seconded by Shauna.
And Shauna, do you want to speak to this one?
Sure. This was actually approached by Mike Lane back in November, and his comment actually started the conversation with myself as well as Frank Krupa and Lee. And Frank and Lee were really the ones that investigated how we can have Narcan in our county buildings. The best solution that we came up with was to actually put them in all of our AED, the defibrillator boxes. And so they are going to work with either the Alcohol and Drug Council to provide the Narcan, or Southern Tier AIDS Program will come in and provide the Narcan as well as the training to county employees. This is something that should be rolled out starting over the next few months, and we're hoping that all of the county buildings will be equipped with them by the end of the year.
And Shauna, you have one small change, which I think probably will be friendly to Rich, if you want to just mention that.
Sure. The change is whereas Tompkins County employs more than, instead of nearly, 700 workers.
Yes, friendly.
Okay. That's in line 23 of the resolution. Okay. All right. Mike Lane?
I just want to thank Shauna and Rich. I think this is so important. We know that in one of our buildings, the Human Services building, that it saved at least one person's life, maybe more. And to have this available in the event of a tragedy happening in front of people's eyes is a small thing that we can do for the safety of our public.
And I hope everybody saw the email from Lee Shurtleff about the maintenance and the schedule for making sure that that's supplied and people are trained. Okay. Ready to vote on this? All in favor, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous.
And then thank resolution you. F, a resolution in support of the upcoming gun buyback program. And I would move it.
Seconded by Anna.
And I would defer to Anna to speak to this issue if she wishes.
Sure, absolutely. So the idea was inspired a bit by a gun buyback that was done a couple of years ago. I think it was 2013. And we're sort of reintroducing the idea in response to a lot of the discussions that have been happening about gun violence. And there's a bit of confusion that gun buybacks are an attempt to get a lot of the AR-15 rifles off the street and a lot of the larger weapons off the street. What these typically do bring back in are the guns that people have in their house that they might have inherited, or guns that they brought into the state and don't fit with maybe the laws that we have here and they don't want to deal with it, and they're not necessarily being stored properly. So the risk of them being taken, being stolen and then sold on the street, or in some cases children getting at them and having accidents with guns. They tend to bring in a smaller amount of those and handguns. And I just wanted to make that clarification because we have gotten some emails. So for anybody who's watching, that's the intention of it. But it also is intended to be educational. It raises the conversation. It goes all day long. There will be some legislators there. The sheriff is leading this. And it is on June 9th, as it says in the resolution. And it is at the fire emergency. I can never remember the name for it. Rich, do you want to help me out with that name? Fire and emergency.
CFR, Crash, Fire, and Rescue.
Thank
there you.
Thank you. That is up by the airport, and that'll be 8:30 to 4 o'clock all day. And that's mostly background.
Any other questions, discussion? All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous.
Okay, and then Resolution G, resolution urging the United States Congress to enact a law mirroring provisions of the assault weapons ban of 2013 that prohibits the sale of assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And I would move it.
Seconded by Henry.
And I would defer to Henry on this one, as it was his motion, to speak to the issue.
So before that, I'd like to make some friendly amendments to it. Changing the assault weapons ban of 2013 to 2017 in the title. Then on line 5 after the first resolution, have it say 2000 ban of 2017, then comma S 2095.
Okay, hold on. So in the title, instead of 2013, it should say 2017?
Yes.
Okay. And what line is
next page?
Next page on the first resolve, line 5.
So that should say 2017.
That says 2017.
And what else?
Then comma, then the bill number S 2095.
Okay.
Then the word prohibits into prohibited. And finally, in line 8, change Kristen to Kirsten, K-I-R.
Friendly.
Thank you. So line 5 on packet page 31 should say 2017, comma, S-2095, as introduced in the United States Senate, that prohibited the sale of assault weapons?
Yes.
Okay, great. Any discussion?
Well, I mean, really the resolution is to just state our opinion, just to tell the people in Congress how we feel about assault weapons. Don't know whether it's going to pass. I kind of doubt it. But we can still hope that this will be, you know, under consideration as a House bill, there's a Senate bill. But really just to sort of put out after the March for Our Lives rally, after the gun buyback program, everything that we stand for, that we can put in a resolution to say how we feel.
Any other discussion? Mike Sigler.
I'm not going to talk too long about this for the simple fact that I think I've written pretty extensively on this issue. I guess I don't understand why, when you have a problem and a solution has been offered up at some other point in history, that we return to that same solution thinking that we're going to get a different outcome. And the only thing that I can come up with is it's good political fodder. You know, this came forward after Sandy Hook, and 60 senators voted against that. And at that point, there was bipartisan opposition to it. I don't see that there's been any movement to actually make a ban actually stick in this country. I look at what Florida did, for example. There was a lot of people saying, we need to change the law, we need to change the law. And the legislature did take its time, and it actually did make some changes to the law. So I would just suggest maybe you take a different approach. Instead of keep saying we want to ban this, the article I wrote was basically, listen, we didn't actually ban machine guns in this country. You can get a machine gun. Very, very difficult to get one, but you can get one. You know, you can get a fully automatic weapon. Basically, what they did was they reclassified the machine gun as something else. And it's the same thing we did with handguns. We didn't ban handguns. We reclassified them as something else. And I feel like you'll make a lot more headway if that's truly the goal, is to say, listen, we want to reduce gun violence in this country. You need both sides to kind of come together on it. And I just don't see how pushing again for a ban brings people that you kind of need to get on board, how it brings them to the table. So, I mean, you can do what you want to do, I suppose. And again, this is a congressional issue. I see a lot of people here who might want to run for Congress. You should. I mean, Tom Reed is up for election right now. Max Dellapia, he's one of your leading candidates, not calling for a ban. Tracy Matrano says she wants to ban, I think, military assault weapons. Those are already banned. So I'm not really sure what she's calling for. She's calling for a ban against bump stocks. Great. Even the NRA wants that. So I just think maybe a different approach than an outright ban of these things might be warranted. There was a man here, and I'll end with this because he was incorrect. He was talking about Heller and how, you know, even a conservative justice said, you know, these things could be banned. What Scalia also said was weapons that are not in common use can be banned. The AR-15, which is really the gun we're kind of talking about, is owned by over 5 million people at this point in this country. So I would say that's in common use. If you want to do something about AR-15s, I would suggest a reclassification, as I've mentioned, as I wrote about, and maybe we can go from there. Thank you very much. I had my 3 minutes.
Deborah.
I'm afraid I just don't find the argument that 5 million people own them, so it must be okay, particularly compelling. It reminds me of when I was a child, and I'd want to do something, and my mother would say no, and I'd say, but all my friends can do it. And she would say, if all your friends ran and jumped off the roof, would you want to do it too? I just don't think 5 million people who somehow or another get their rocks off by shooting an AR-15 when they don't need an AR-15 to shoot what they're trying to shoot should make it okay to have an AR-15. An AR-15 is a weapon that makes it possible to kill a lot of people really quickly. That's its only use. That's what it was designed for. We don't want people out there shooting a lot of people really quickly unless they're our military. And that's not what we're talking about here.
Thank you. Rich?
Mike, I agree with you that a national conversation that actually speaks across the divide would be really useful. And I'm sometimes skeptical when we take positions on national issues where it's really not a decision we can make. But in this instance, I think it's worthwhile for the legislature in Tompkins County, as our guests spoke on privilege of the floor, to say, make a statement, to say, there's a better way to do this, and you have to start somewhere. There are reasonable, in my view, there are reasonable gun controls that most of the people in this country could agree to, and yet we have political gridlock. And I think it's largely due to money in politics that these people are getting substantial donations from the gun lobby. And unless we are making these statements saying there should be movement here, nothing will happen. And certainly you're right, nothing has happened. But that doesn't mean we should be silent. But I agree with you entirely. It's a very small piece. It's not going to solve the problem by itself, and yet you do what you can. And I think there's more to come. And I think there's more. I think we can get there. But I don't see that we're harming that process at all by considering this resolution. And I say that where I believe people should have the right to hunt. I don't agree with the speaker who said we should not have any guns in this country. I don't think that's feasible, and I think that the Second Amendment does mean something for reasonable gun use. But it is such a problem in our cities and outside of our cities, too. I don't think being silent is a reasonable pathway. Thanks.
Anna?
Yeah, thank you guys all for those comments. I would just add to, for no other reason, and there's many reasons, but I think this would be enough, that the youth across our entire country have come out in droves asking us to do something and not let money make and rule our decisions. And I think that we owe it to the youth in our communities who, even in Tompkins County, have come out and said, we want less guns on the street. Flat out, less guns on the street means less violence. There was an amazing video that came out from inner city Baltimore, and I've watched it now three times, and the youth were saying, every single one of them had experienced someone dying in front of them by guns. Every single one of them in this group, in this focus group. And they liked going to school because the one place they felt safe was the school because there were metal detectors in every single doorway leading into the school. That shouldn't be. And I think that we it's time. The other thing that I would say is, you know, we do talk about not wanting to make too many statements locally on issues that are federal, but we forget that us passing a resolution means that there's a resolution on the books, and that can then be passed to all the other counties in the state. The state's passing it, sharing it, and if we get a tipping point of counties sharing it, that makes a difference. So maybe we're starting one, but it doesn't mean it has to end here. We can share it. So I just want to keep that in mind.
Anyone else? Ann, and then Mike, and then I want to say something.
I just want to possible correction of interpretation of some part of what Mike Sigler said was that the banning of weapons that people or guns that people have. I don't think you meant that. Could be wrong. That just because a lot of people have them meant that it was okay.
Right.
But that was just what a judicial person was saying that they felt what might be a place to go. But so I was already contacted by somebody from the village of Trumansburg who wanted to know if we were going, you know, wanted to know if this got passed tonight. They wanted to mirror that. Also possibly a mirror resolution for this. And people are, children and other people are looking at us to see what we're doing. And I feel if this is some small thing that we can do, I think we should do it. And I'm hoping that on a federal level, something like this can get passed. And this is a step in the right direction. And then hopefully we can build upon that. I think a lot more needs to be done. And as people have said, we need to bring people together and figure out how to do that. And maybe we can do that locally to get the conversation going and bring people together.
Mike Sickman?
I'll be really quick. Thank you. That's what I was going to say. But I also wanted to say that, you know, New York State passed the SAFE Act. So a lot of people were against that. A lot of people were for it. It did pass. And that actually covers a lot of the things that we're talking about here. So just something to keep in mind.
So I would just add that just because something didn't pass a few years ago is not a reason to bring it, not a reason not to bring it up again. For example, the women's rights centennial, the sentiment of Declaration of Sentiments in 1848 in Seneca Falls declared that women ought to have the right to vote. It wasn't until 1920 that we got it. So people change, things change. In fact, the Senate and the Congress aren't the same people who were there when this came up last time. So I think this is important to do, and I do commend you to for often being in a small minority in this group, and appreciate that you continue to bring up your points of view and
I'm
have a good discussion.
I'm heartened. For a year, I heard that, you know, Donald Trump was a fascist than Hitler. And we're apparently saying he is not, because otherwise you wouldn't disarm people. So I find that heartening.
Okay. You really want to start that? I don't think so.
Maybe you just killed your argument.
How long do we want this meeting to go?
Okay. Henry.
I just also want to say that, yes, this, you know, the odds of this passing are probably slim, but we know there's been a renewed movement about gun control in America. We also know that the person who shot up the Parkland school was, you know, not 21. And so maybe, perhaps, this law could start
being moving people to raise the age of selling these weapons to people who are 21, people who don't have mental incapacity, so something else. So, again, we have to start somewhere.
Leslie?
Never mind, Madam Chair. I was going to say something about the SAFE Act, and Mike had brought it up already, but I'm good. Thank you.
Ann, did you have your hand up again?
Yeah, I just wanted to correct something that I had said earlier. I said the village of Trumansburg, someone had contacted me, but it was the town of Ulysses.
Thank you. And if I could just ask that we add Tom to line 8 on page 31. Assume that's...
Friendly.
There actually is another...
Reed.
Reed. All right. Thank you. Are we ready to vote? Okay. All in favor of Resolution G, please raise your hands. Any opposed? One opposed, so that is 12 to 1. And it passes.
And I have Resolution H, appropriation from contingent fund, terminal pay reimbursement, Department of Probation, and Community Justice. And I would move it.
Seconded by Anna. Any discussion? We need a short form roll call.
Ms. Kellis?
Yes.
Mr. John?
Yes.
Are there any no's? All right, that passes. Why don't we take Henry, you want to do your
I've got one more resolution.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's right. Okay. Go ahead.
Resolution K, a resolution in support of the New York State legislation establishing a third county court judge in Tompkins County. And I would move it.
Seconded by Mike Lane. Discussion?
This is in support of a Senate bill that would establish another position in Tompkins County. Whether it's possible this budget cycle or not, we're not sure, but it seems worthwhile to put the issue out there, and we've been told that passing the resolution would aid in supporting the legislation, the proposed legislation.
Thank you. Mike? Mike Lane?
I would just point out that we're short judges in Tompkins County. We have fewer judges for our population than some of the other counties like Chemung. We have problems with some of that our county judges have to act as Supreme Court judges because our Supreme Court judges have been moved up to the appellate division. There's no mechanism to add judges in our 6th Judicial District, and we just kind of our judges just get overloaded. And the result of that, certainly at the county court level, is they can't move cases as fast. And that means more people in our jail that we can't get processed and out. And that's why we've got to have more judges.
Anyone else? I would agree. This is really important. I want to thank Rich for pulling this together very quickly. And you had a couple of the judges support, you know, give
yes,
us some information.
They were very helpful.
Can I just, it's Pam Helming, right? It's not Patricia?
It's Pamela.
Pamela?
Oh, sorry.
So
yes, it is Pamela.
So that's the first line and then on the back, right?
I would consider that change friendly.
Okay.
So would Senator Helming.
Yes.
It would help. Probably would help. Yeah, real appreciation of Senator Helming for taking this step and kind of on her own. And it's really great with Senator O'Mara. All right, Deborah.
Does this mean we'll lose another parking space?
We can hope. We can hope. It would be worth losing the parking space.
I can have mine.
Okay, all in favor of this resolution, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you very much. Great.
I just had one other thing. The Tompkins County Sheriff's Department jail statistics, which anybody in the public can go look at, shows the population of the jail and the board outs. We've been running about 4 board outs a day for quite a while through April or through March and then into April. But last Friday, I think it was, we went down to 1, and we seem to be sticking at 1 for a bit. So,
woo-hoo.
But we're certainly right at the edge where we are still needing to use board outs. And we need to get our alternatives to incarceration, all the programs that we have set up, really operating to bring that number down just a little bit, marginally, and we will save a lot of money on our operations and make it a lot easier and better for the inmates that are there. So,
thank you very much, Rich. Henry?
Sure, talking about that. OAR did a presentation of public safety about their numbers, their impact on the community. Also, they had a person there talk about the college initiative in which they sponsor people to go to TC3 to earn a degree. The Sheriff's Department also came. They talked about the board outs and other issues. They also discussed an ICE arrest at the county jail, which the sheriff did not know the name of the person, but they contacted them a few hours before. The Sheriff's Department said they didn't have an order, and so they did not help them. But when the person was released from county jail on bond or whatever, then they were arrested. Also, probation had a monthly spotlight for us of their work.
Any questions for Henry? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, all set. Why don't we take a break, and we'll come back for the Health and Human Services Committee. Let's take 10 minutes and then come back to your seats by 8. Thank you. Okay, folks. We're back in session. Before I go to Health and Human Services, I just, since it's sort of family here now, I saw Joe Mariana today, and he's doing well. It's a roller coaster, but he's making progress, and he's looking forward to joining us next week at Gravity Renewables. So,
cool.
Yeah. And he says hi, and he says thank you for all the cards and gift cards and flowers and strawberry ice cream and stuff. So.
Does he watch us faithfully every week?
Well, tonight I'm afraid he's watching the Yankees. I think we failed the level of interest test tonight.
Oh. No, it's just Jason's so good.
I've spoken to Joe probably once or twice a week. Mm-hmm. I was asking about what's going on. He seems in good spirit.
Yeah, he does. He really, and he's still earning that that contingent fund fee. I mean that consultant fee. He's still earning that, I will say. All right, Shauna Black, Health and Human Services Committee Chair.
Our Health and Human Services Committee last met Monday, April 9th. John Manzello and Kathy Schlatter from Human Services Coalition joined us to discuss 211. There will be two new features that will start shortly. One of them is a text option so that people can text them directly to receive referral information. And then new feature is they receive grant funding that will increase the options for Medicaid recipients that need help with medical transportation. So those vouchers will be provided directly through 211. Our next HHS meeting is May 14th at 4 p.m. Sue Day Hall will present from the Child Development Council.
Very good. Any questions for Shauna? Thank you, Shauna.
Thank you.
I'm sorry? Okay. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you, Martha. F and I met just previous to this meeting this evening for a special meeting, and our regularly scheduled meeting will be this coming Thursday at 3 in these chambers. The reason for today's meeting was a resolution for the Tompkins Center for History and Culture. That resolution ended up being pulled this evening, and we'll be back in approximately 2 weeks. And we also had a short discussion on the non-pipe alternative that Martha mentioned earlier in regard to the airport, and that is still in limbo. We don't have any information on that at this point. That's my report.
Any questions for Dave? Mike?
Dave, we talked a little bit about the idea of maybe a presentation from Highway about road and bridge projects for the year. Is that going to happen?
Yes. I got to get it set up, but I have to apologize. I didn't get it done yet.
Great.
I will. Well, that would
be nice to get it before the too far into the season.
Well, I'll ask Jeff about it on Thursday. See if we can set it up for the next meeting, perhaps.
Great.
Thank you, Dave. Transportation Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
We have not met since our last meeting. We will meet again on May 4th. That's a Friday. And we will try again to get TCAT to come in and talk about their plans and how they're proceeding toward the idea of a new facility. Or an updated facility, I should say.
Thank you. Questions for Mike? Thanks very much, Mike. Government Operations, Dan Klein, Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to start by moving Resolution I, 2018, Membership Authorization and Appropriation from Contingent Fund for the International City County Management Association.
That's ID 7724. Is there a second? Shauna seconds. Discussion? Any questions? All right, ready to vote? Short form roll call.
Ms. Kellis?
Yes.
Mr. John?
Yes.
Are there any no's? That's unanimous. Thank you, and thank you for including all this documentation and information about ICMA. It's great. It looks like a great opportunity. All right, Dan, other report?
Yeah, we met on April 5th. So the Bicentennial Committee and Rod Howe, the Director of the History Center, and Carol Kamen, our county historian, are proposing the formation of a permanent Tompkins County Historical Commission. The purpose would be to continue celebrating local history, significant anniversaries, and to help bring out stories about those whose stories are not being told. So look for some action coming soon to establish some kind of commission. I think we have to call it something different than a commission. We're going to figure out a better word. Also on the local history front, we had continued discussion about honoring Elizabeth Beebe, who you might regard as the first social worker in Ithaca more than 100 years ago. And we want to put up some kind of plaque at the Human Services Building. And there's a good chance it's going to be more than a little plaque. There's a really interesting possibility of a really nice display that we can do. So stand by for details on that. We're going to do a site visit to the Human Services Building sometime soon to figure out where this thing might go. And then we had a big, long discussion about the county website. We did not take any action. Our information technology department was there, and we learned that there are about 50 people in the county who contribute content to the website. And so, you know, you might consider that a decentralized website, right? There's a lot of people feeding into it. And a lot of people listed their concerns about the website, and it had to do with things like not being able to find things easily, not being able to navigate easily, and when you look at that kind of uniformity, you're talking about a centralized system. So that's one of the basic questions that we're going to need to resolve before we can get very far in prescribing what we're looking for. Do we want to stick with a decentralized, or do we want to go towards a centralized system? So I think this is going to take many months of discussion to kind of work through some of these basic questions, because when we get to the point where we say what we want, we have to be very clear what it is we want. We can't be vague. And then finally, we received the annual foreclosure report about properties in the county that are being foreclosed upon. When we first got the report, there were 21 properties listed. It's now down to 19. And you can expect the number to continue to decrease. Hopefully, it'll go to zero. Sometimes it goes to, I think it, one year went to zero. The auction is June 18th, and as we get closer to that date, people find ways by hook or by crook to pay off their taxes and keep their property. That's my report.
Thank you very much, Dan. Any questions or comments? Leslin?
So I know as legislators, we usually get a copy of that report, but I haven't seen one. Did we get one?
I prepare that, and that will be forthcoming. We usually go through this step first, but we did it a month earlier than we've ever done before because we wanted to see if there were going to be any properties pulled, which this committee tends to do that action, and they recommended just one this year out of the whole batch, and then that one happened to be redeemed just before the meeting, so there aren't any being pulled. But you will be, the whole legislator will get a full report before the auction on all the properties.
Thank you.
Did the planning department have its review? Is that the one that was thinking of pulling?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else for Dan? All right, thanks very much. Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality Committee, Anna Kell is chair.
We will be meeting this coming Monday, the 23rd, at 3 p.m., and I'm actually looking forward to several presentations. It's a very packed meeting. Some of you might want to come for some of it. TCAD will be presenting, giving an overview of their programs that they do, as well as their budget, which some of us have been trying to wrap our brains around. I think that will be very helpful. The CBB from the Chamber of Commerce will also be presenting on the marketing and outreach that they do to the rest of the world about how great we are and to get tourists to come to our area. And the last presentation will be ST8, which is the new rebranded name of what was previously known as STURBD, the Southern Tier East Regional Economic Development Program or something to that effect, which I can never remember the long name, nor can most of us. They will also be presenting, as everybody may remember, last year was the first time that we became a member in a while to that group. It's the annual fee that we put in. This will give us a sense of what it is that we are getting for that and what is the value added of being a member. So for anybody who wants to join, those will be the presentations. And that's it.
Thanks, Anna. Any questions? Leslie.
So at our last meeting, or maybe the one before that, there was a lot of conversation around ACOT funding, and the request was made to engage in conversation way ahead of time so we can set some parameters or at least come to some mutual understanding of what our expectations are and so on and so forth if things need to change. I don't remember who's responsible for setting that up, but I know they referred it to you. And I'd like to make sure that it's on the radar to be set up and have this meeting happen before we get to the point again where we're in the same situation.
So I can speak to that quickly. That is definitely on the radar. The first step was to bring a group of the STPB members together to debrief. There was a lot that happened. That meeting has happened. That was organized by Katie and Nick. Anything moving forward will come be organized by Katie and Nick. And it is not just understanding the role of the arts and culture. Mm-hmm. The conversation will also be understanding the larger role of the room tax, how it plays into tourism, how it feeds back into tourism, all the different organizations so that we can get a larger scope, and then also a discussion moving forward of what is the appropriate type of funding relationship with the different categories. So all of that conversation has been happening. Jason, did you have anything? I'll let you know of updates. I don't know if you had anything added.
I've been in touch with Katie and Nick because they've had those conversations.
Can you pull your microphone close?
No, other than Katie's brought me up to speed as she's and her and Nick have been meeting with the STBB members.
Right, and it's very important that they take the lead and drive that, so supporting that and supporting them.
I mean, they're facilitating the conversation between the group, and I think that's what's important, that they have to, you know, they have to evaluate this themselves and they have to come up with some suggestions to bring back.
And I would just add that Katie's talked to me about the fact that that their budget is usually approved like in June and comes to us, or May or June, and comes to us early so that it feeds into the county's budget process. In fact, their whole budget doesn't have to be completely outlined as they usually do it in time for us. We just need the top line numbers, how much is coming, how much is projected for next year, and how much would be coming to the county in our particular buckets, that they can continue to process over the summer and develop their final budget by September or so.
And I just wanted to know also coming up at this meeting next week is four or five resolutions. I think it's four resolutions for additional grants that are coming through. The review committees have met. For example, I'm on the Tourism Capital Grant Committee. We just met and went through those last week, as did, I think, three or four others. So those will be coming through this coming Monday.
Okay, anything else? Dan.
Yeah, you mentioned the TCAD budget, and you said you've been trying to wrap your brain around it. What did you mean? Because I've been asking to see, the outlines of what was being proposed. Has that been out there somewhere?
So that will be coming the following month, not this coming month. And I didn't mean specifically wrapping our minds around the budget for this year specifically. What I'm talking about is, where do they spend their money? Everybody knows the general overview of the 30% or third coming from the three different. What does that exactly mean? What is the trend of that? Where are their reserves? How much reserve do they have? Where is it being spent? What is it used for? Like, all those types of questions that would help us understand, and specifically also, what are the programs? Not the glossy overview of, the annual booklet that we get, but lifting the hood up and really getting to understand the programs better so that we have a sense of we're contributing regardless of where our contribution comes from for the third. We are contributing. Where does that go to? And I think that the, there are a lot of returning legislators that want to know, but then there are also new legislators that have approached me and said, I'd really like to get a better sense of what the TCAD budget is and where it goes and what it's used for. So it's
Thank
that.
You. Thank you.
Okay, and I would remind folks that over the weekend, Jason sent the 2012 report, right, the report of the 2012 task force, which is many pages long and included a number of sub-reports that were very interesting and helpful. I'd read them 5 years ago, but it's really a good refresher. There's a lot of information there sort of that backed up kind of that documented what the task force thought about, what they considered, and why they made the recommendations that they did. So anything else for Anna? All right. Thank you, Anna. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
You all know how much I dislike having to miss meetings. I was not able to be at the meeting, and I'll turn to Leslin, who thankfully chaired it in my absence, and perhaps she could give us a report.
Thank you, Mike. I'd be happy to. And yes, we did miss you. We met. We talked.
Numbers were thrown around.
Thank you, Mike. I don't remember what we talked about anymore. So, one of the things we dealt with was TC3, and you heard about that already tonight on the Child Care Center, plus Blixie just giving us an overview of where they were. Quick sneak peek into the budget prior to our May 11th meeting. They were well pleased to let us know that they received a little extra funding from the state. They were not looking to the partners, the local partners, for any increases. They budgeted $75 per FTE. The state came back with $100 per FTE, so that was a little bump. Then they did not expect. They're concerned about potential changes to the chargeback formula, which will vary from college to college. So I don't know what it's going to look like yet, but they figure that might have an impact on our budget. They let us also know some good news for students coming in. There'll be no tuition increases for the 18-19 school year. And also the fact that they are in positive negotiations with their bargaining units. So that was just a Cliff Notes version of our conversation with them. So when we go to the meeting on the 11th, we'll hear an even more in-depth conversation about the budget.
We also spent some time with our Human Resources Department talking about the evaluation of her direct reports. We know that as a legislature, our responsibility is to annually provide a performance evaluation of clerk of the legislature, county attorney, finance director, and a county administrator. We charged at budget a few meetings ago, asked the HR department to come back to us with proposed tool we can use and or process. Steve Estes, Deputy Commissioner of Human Resources, did give us an example of our 360 tool that we can use. Seems simple enough, but we're also still looking for more feedback on sort of how to roll that out. One of the big questions had to do with if we're doing a 360, who decides which groups will respond to it? Is it peers? Is it community stakeholders? Who makes that decision? Is it us? Do we ask the direct reports to say to us who they want to participate in this evaluation, etc.? So stay tuned. There is more information to come. Amy Guerrieri, our commissioner, did send us a sample evaluation tool to use. I don't know if it went to everyone, probably just to the committee. First to take a look at, so it takes about 7 minutes for us to do that. So we're still in the process of trying to make sure that we have a developed tool and a process that we can then share with our entire legislative body. One of the things that Steve did mention is at our last one we did, we didn't get 100% response from our legislature. This is just a reminder. It'll come out. This really is our responsibility to do that. So you'll see things, a tool coming out with some potential questions and a process, a recommended, a suggested process, and we'll be looking for feedback so that we can move along with this. And if any other committee members who are not as brain fried as I am remember anything else, feel free to add to that.
Thank you, Leslyn. Anything else? Any questions? Leslyn, would we, the rest of the legislature, see this tool that you recommend, that the committee will recommend, before we kind of jump into it?
Most likely, because we do want your input. But not dragged out inputs. Let me just punctuate there right now. Because we do efficient input, because we do need to move this along.
Right. Okay, great. And the climate survey, that's been announced and rolled out, right? And
no. Well, yes, the letter went out from Jason, you and I, to county attorneys, letting them know it's coming. Thank you for that, Martha. I should have mentioned it on the WDIC. It is going to be coming. We are still talking with our vendor. We sent back some thoughts and questions and suggestions. We had a conference call with them, a go-to-meeting thing over the phone with them. Went back and forth on some questions. We got input on questions. And if any one of you remember from the last survey that you took, or if you need a refresher, we can certainly send you a copy. If you think that there is a question or questions that didn't get addressed or an area, it's not too late. We're trying to wrap this up, so get it to us as quickly as possible, please.
Good. I thought we saw the letter went out, and I thought, oh, wait. Are we supposed to already have filled out the survey?
No, it's coming.
Okay.
It's coming. And there's going to be, more marketing information that comes out. The marketing team is busy. The survey review team is busy. The leadership team is busy. So we have several teams working to make this a very successful survey process again.
Not just one letter. Got it. Good.
Yeah, that was just one.
All right. One other question. Just the you said TC3 sees an added. It's $100 per FTE additional to their previous allocations?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else for Leslin? Dave?
Not for Leslin. Just a general announcement. I just got a notice on my phone that Barbara Bush has passed away.
Yes, I just saw that myself.
Wow. Okay.
92.
Thank you, Dave. Leslin?
Thank you, Dave, for that. I just saw that as well. I ask about the SCPB, and I also am hoping that at some point we can get a report on how the airport is doing. I don't know where that comes from or who it comes from, but I'd really I'm interested in knowing how are things going there. In general.
Facilities, in Plain Mensen, Del. Just how much traffic and...
Yeah, traffic, how are we trending, how are we... Pardon? Things go up and they come down. And...
Thank you, Deborah.
Yeah. And if there's anything we should be looking forward to for this upcoming, budget.
Right.
We should be on top of these things.
Dave is writing it down. All right,
thank
good.
You,
thank you very much, Dave. All right, that's it for budget and capital. Anything else? Thank you very much, Leslin and Mike. We did the member file. That was the courts. We have the minutes of April 3rd. Can I get a motion? Moved by Anna, seconded by Amanda. Yes, Amanda?
Yeah, I just wanted to make one change. I don't know. Brian Eden, let's see, on page 3, he should be noted as the chair of the Environmental Management Council, not a member.
What packet page?
Oh, packet page 49.
Okay.
He's Brian Eden, third down from the top.
The third paragraph, okay. And chair of the Environmental Management Council.
Yeah.
Okay. Good, got that. Ann?
There is, I wanted to see about adding Jonathan Wood's report from last session. So do I need to make an amendment to that?
Yeah, that'd be make a move to amend.
Okay. I'd like to move to amend to add that Jonathan Wood provided a detailed report of the functions of the New York State Division of Human Rights to the full legislature last time.
Thank you. And that, I think, would go on packet page 58 after the chair's report. Is there a second for that? Second by Shauna. Any discussion? Leslin?
Could you just repeat what it is you want to add to the minutes? You want to modify the minutes to say what?
To add that Jonathan Wood provided a detailed report on the functions of the New York State Division of Human Rights at our last meeting.
Okay, so just the action that we asked Jonathan to do is what that he did.
That he did it.
Thank you.
That he reported. I was noting this. I was looking through the minutes and I realized, hey, there was no mention at all about Jonathan's report that went to the notes, and there's a long explanation there, almost not quite verbatim, but a very informative section in our notes. So I thought if at least, and I, so full disclosure, I asked, it's not really appropriate for me to make a motion from here, so I asked, would anybody be willing to move this? And Ann and Shauna said yes. The idea being that if somebody's looking through our minutes, they'll go, oh, I'm interested in that, and then they would go to the notes. So that's a reason to do that here. The conversation was elaborated with Kathy Covert's note about what's happening with the minutes policy. Kathy, would you mind letting folks know what's in the works on the minutes policy?
There's a proposal to revise the minutes policy and remove the reference to notes, and that one document would be produced after a meeting. It's under review by the county administrator and will be coming forward through the committee process.
Okay. So for the moment, this is a thing that we can do just to direct people. But in the future, we may end up, the idea is to end up with one document where people would see everything in one place. So I really appreciate that. And by the way, anybody can ask that something be added to the record, in particular about their own comments. If you want to say, I voted no, please note in the record, I voted no for such and such a reason. And that'll go in the minutes, so just so people know. Mike?
Just a point of clarification. Isn't that the thing that Dooley asked for about a decade? Just
Dan, you want to answer that?
It's under review by the committee process.
Yes. So there is a motion to amend, unless this is friendly to who moved the minutes in the first place. Anne moved, you moved the minutes and seconded, what? Anna. Anna moved them and seconded by?
Amanda.
Amanda. So is this friendly to add these?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's accepted.
Oh,
as friendly.
For them.
What?
I thought you were talking about the amendment. I'm like, I didn't
know. No, you moved the minutes.
We did the minutes, yes.
Okay.
Friendly.
All right. With that, is there anything else on the minutes of April 3rd? All right. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. All right. I get a motion to adjourn. Moved by Deborah, seconded by Leslin. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you all.